This is Brother Peter Diamond, and I'm going to be talking about the issue of jurisdiction. Certain people in the traditional movement hold the no jurisdiction position. This is the position that jurisdiction is only acquired from a lawful superior, and therefore, since all of the independent priests, and even the priests ordained after the election of the Vatican II antipopes, were not approved by lawful superiors, they do not have jurisdiction. Since jurisdiction is necessary for a priest to validly absolve in the confessional, a lack of jurisdiction on their part would mean that all of the confessions they hear are invalid. Many traditionalists remain unaware of the fact that in order for a priest to validly absolve in the confessional, he not only needs to be validly ordained in the traditional rite of ordination by a bishop who is consecrated in the traditional rite of episcopal consecration, but he must also possess what is called jurisdiction or the authority from the church to hear the confession and forgive the sins of the penitent. In Session 14, Chapter 7, the Council of Trent declared, quote, "This absolution which the priest pronounces upon one over whom he has no ordinary or delegated jurisdiction has no value," end quote. So we can see why the issue of jurisdiction is quite important. The Code of Canon Law contains laws on how jurisdiction is obtained. Normally, it is from a bishop with ordinary jurisdiction, who received his jurisdiction from a true pope. Since essentially all of the independent priests and other priests offering traditional sacraments today did not receive approval from a bishop who was approved by Pius XII, the last true pope, these people conclude that they do not and cannot have jurisdiction to hear confessions and do the other things that they do. In this talk, I will show why this position is completely wrong and refuted by Catholic history, by Catholic sense, by Catholic teaching, and even by the canon law commentaries which they wrongly think favor their position. We have addressed and refuted this completely false position in an article on our website, which can be found under Traditional Catholic Issues and Groups. However, there are many other facts and points that need to be covered to more thoroughly demolish this schismatic error. The biggest problem with the no jurisdiction position is that it fails to understand the distinction between ecclesiastical laws and divine laws. The laws of the church which govern how jurisdiction is granted are ecclesiastical laws. That's why they've been changed many times. They fall into the same category as other laws which have been modified and revoked by popes. There were countless such ecclesiastical laws issued by past ecumenical councils. There were laws governing how monks were not allowed to hunt, how priests were to be accepted into certain dioceses, how no one was to found a new religious order, and on and on and on. Unlike dogmatic truths, ecclesiastical laws can be revoked, can be modified, and can cease to apply in a situation or in a necessity that was not envisioned by the lawgiver. In addition, the Church teaches that jurisdiction will be supplied in various circumstances to those who did not receive it in the normal fashion. These principles, including supplied jurisdiction, epikaia, and some others we will discuss, are mentioned in virtually every canon law commentary on these subjects. The application of supplied jurisdiction to this issue, namely, that the Church will automatically supply or grant jurisdiction to one who has not received it in the normal fashion, either because there is a situation of common error or a probable doubt of law or fact, is such an indisputable fact that this concept of supplied jurisdiction is specifically mentioned in the very Code of Canon Law itself. In Canon 209 of the 1917 Code of Canon Law, it states, quote, "In common error, or in positive or probable doubt about either law or fact, the Church supplies jurisdiction for both the external and internal forum," end quote. Now, by merely citing this canon, we can already refute some of the advocates of the no jurisdiction position. For instance, one Barbara Linenberg wrote a work against the idea that any of the independent priests could have supplied jurisdiction, a work which is fraught with serious doctrinal errors. She states on page 10, quote, "The apostles would be horrified today to see what has been added to the meaning of tradition, that is, epikaia, common error and church-supplied jurisdictions, or whatever else might sound plausible to the unwary to sanction these deceptions," end quote. We can see that the very code of canon law itself teaches supplied jurisdiction, a concept she calls horrible. Now, other advocates of the no jurisdiction position are a bit more theologically astute. They acknowledge the concept of supplied jurisdiction, but place grave restrictions on it. They often say that it's not granted to someone who has not been given jurisdiction in the first place, so that, for instance, the church only supplies jurisdiction to someone who has already been a valid priest approved by a proper bishop, but whose jurisdiction has lapsed, or who is trying to use jurisdiction in a locality where he does not have it. And so they acknowledge supplied jurisdiction, but say that it is only granted to someone who has received approval and jurisdiction before. And this is, of course, completely false as well. This is refuted, first of all, when we consider the fact that the Church has always taught that all validly ordained priests in danger of death can absolve a well-meaning penitent. Even though they were never granted jurisdiction to hear confessions, they are given the jurisdiction automatically by the Church for the needs of the person who is approaching them in danger of death. In fact, this is also specifically mentioned in the 1917 Code of Canon Law. Canon 882 of the 1917 Code of Canon Law states, quote, "In danger of death, all priests and bishops, even those not approved for confessions, validly and licitly absolve all penitents whatsoever, of all sins and censures whatsoever, no matter how reserved or notorious," end quote. And this concept of supplying jurisdiction to priests who never had it before in danger of death did not simply come into existence with the 1917 Code of Canon Law, but was acknowledged throughout the history of the Church. Furthermore, in this very canon we see another example of the distinction between ecclesiastical laws and divine laws. There have been many canon laws surrounding the reservation of sins. For example, if a person would commit a certain act which would carry with it a specific excommunication, such as procuring an abortion, sometimes that would be reserved for a higher superior, so that only certain individuals could forgive those sins. But in danger of death or in certain necessities, those reservations do not apply. And so, with these two preliminary facts and examples we've given, we can refute and knock down the first two pillars of the no jurisdiction position. Some of the advocates of the no jurisdiction position say that the Church cannot supply jurisdiction and does not supply jurisdiction to anyone who has not been approved in the normal fashion. That is, of course, completely wrong and refuted by the very code of canon law itself. Others argue that the Church only supplies jurisdiction to those who have been previously approved by the Church and given jurisdiction. We can see that that is wrong as well. But that is not sufficient to refute their arguments, for many of them will admit that the Church will supply jurisdiction to people it has not approved previously, but that it does that only in danger of death. They contend that the Church does not supply jurisdiction to priests who were not previously approved to carry on a regular priestly apostolate and repeatedly hear confessions and perform the other actions that apply to the priesthood. So, is there any evidence that the Church will automatically supply jurisdiction to a priest who has not been properly approved by a true religious superior and repeatedly give him jurisdiction to hear confessions and continue on in the other actions that are proper to the priesthood?